of course, the first female president, should she win in November, of course she has to kind of get there by slaying this seven-headed dragon of, you know, rape culture and horrible misogyny and racism and Islamophobia.
Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm David Rothkopf, CEO and editor, and you're listening to the ER. I'm in New York today, and we're joined from Washington by FP columnist Julia Yaffe. Julia is also a contributing writer for Politico magazine and Highline. Also joining from Washington is another one of our FP columnists, Rosa Brooks, senior Future of War Fellow at New America, professor at Georgetown University, and author of How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything. And Ed Luce, the Financial Times chief U.S. commentator and columnist. Thank you again to our dedicated ER nerds for continuing to submit ideas. We appreciate your enthusiasm and hope you'll keep them coming. Send your best ideas and you may get a mug. We're at erpodcasts@foreignpolicy.com. Recently, from not one but two tiny podcast studios, one high above Washington's DuPont Circle and the other here in cool Brooklyn, we had the following conversation. One of the things that I get the most comments from folks regarding this podcast is that we talk about Donald Trump too much. And although I have the utmost respect for our listeners, we're going to keep doing that. It's not Donald Trump I really want to talk about. What I really want to talk about is what this election tells us about the direction of the richest, most powerful country in the world, and what it tells us about where we may be after the election. Because there are a couple of subtexts to this election that are really, really unusual, I think, in American politics and have global implications. One is the nature of Trump's support, who they are, what their views are, and what that may mean for the future of politics. By that, I particularly mean the nationalist impulse, the white supremacist subset, the anti-Semitic, anti-immigration subset. And then, of course, there is this other component, and that is that this election seems to be being contested not just by political candidates in the United States, but by foreign actors, notably the Russian government, that seems actively involved in trying to influence the outcome. I want to take these in two different pieces and try to keep our answers with an eye towards the future. Julia, you've been writing very powerfully and tweeting very powerfully, if one can powerfully tweet, about some of the sort of darker subtexts of Trump's support, notably anti-Semitism, but also racism, misogyny, nationalism. Is something really different going on here, or is this a continuum of past elections?
I think it's both. To be honest, I think in some ways, you know, we're witnessing a very classic moment of reaction, of revenge. So in some ways, this is a continuation of 2008, in which the country, the election of 2008, in which the country elected its first black president, which, far from ending racism in this country and tying this ugly part of our country's history in a nice, neat bow of kumbaya and friendship of the peoples, in fact, lanced a boil that I think many people were trying to ignore or were hoping would go away on its own. And I think we're seeing a lot of those issues coming out now with a renewed vigor, a renewed force. I think as the country is, you know, one of the people that is most likely to be president in January is a woman, which would be a first for the U.S. And if it makes to me, perfect sense that she would be running against the most misogynistic, like cartoonishly misogynistic male candidate, that she's not running against a subtly misogynistic Republican who's very genteel and, you know, his misogyny, if he has some, is very veiled and polite and covered up by issues. This is just overt. You know, it's, of course, the first female president, should she win in November, of course, she has to kind of get there by slaying this seven-headed dragon of, you know, rape culture and horrible misogyny and racism and Islamophobia. Like, to me, it kind of makes sense both as something new and as an outgrowth, a reaction to 2008 and 2012, in which we elected and then reelected the country's first black president.
So you would, are you saying that this is sort of a backlash by a minority of Americans against a broader and more pervasive progressive impulse in America and demographic change, in which case, if you're looking forward, that might continue and this backlash, while it may rumble for a while, will be overwhelmed by it? Or is it something that has a chance of reasserting itself?
I don't know that it's a minority just yet. I think we're kind of at a tipping point. This is a historical demographic group that has been the majority for the majority of the history of the U.S. They have wielded the most power. And, you know, if you look at demographic data where American children under five, white children under five are a minority, you know, it's a kind of hard, people are looking down the pike and seeing a country that looks totally different from the one A, they grew up in, and B, controlled most of the resources and power. And so this is, in some ways, a reaction to a redistribution of resources and power. And I think it's going to continue as the demographics keep shifting.
I think that you bring up a very important point in terms of the longer-term issue. The demographic shift that's taking place in the United States is unprecedented in its history. As you point out, 2013, for the first time, those that we had once thought of as minorities, which is to say African Americans, Latinos, and Asians, actually comprised the majority in one cadre, which is the under fives. By 2020, that'll be true in another cadre, essentially under 18s. Every young person in America by the next election will be living with that reality. And according to the U.S. Census Bureau, by 2043, that'll be true for the entire country. So by 2043, the traditional white majority will actually be in minority relative to these minority groups. Ed, you've been thinking a lot about this change. Do you think there's something here in this election that is abnormal because Donald Trump is abnormal, or do you see it as a continuation and that there are underlying trends that we need to keep an eye on?
Well, I agree with everything Julius said. I mean, if you look at whether the Republican Party will heed the demographic signals from the likely defeat of Trump, what would give me pause is to look at how the Republican Party in California has behaved over the last 25 years, which is to double down, to retreat to the lager, as it were, to circle the wagons, rather than reach out to the new demographics in California, to the Hispanics and Asian Americans. It's become more and more of a rejectionist party and a white party. And I think that's partly to do with gerrymandering. It's to do with the fact that, you know, their interests lie in staving off primary challenges. And so if you were to look at whether the districts at a federal level across all 50 states, you know, are going to incentivize the National Republican Party to behave differently to the Californian, I have to say I'd be a little bit skeptical of that. And I think if, as is probable, Paul Ryan has a significantly reduced majority in the House on November the 9th, that the Freedom Caucus will take up a larger share of his party than before, just by virtue of the fact that the swing districts are where you find the more, if the term applies, moderate Republicans. So I'm a little bit skeptical that that we're going to see a change in behavior from the Republican Party. And I think, as Julia says, we have the sort of perfect storm here of racial fear, ethnic fear about whites becoming a minority, and latent misogyny in the form of, you know, the likely first female president of America. And it's if these are real causes, if these are real parts of what's happening, that those kinds of sentiments take a long time to fade away. You know, they don't just suddenly disappear because an election result went wrong.
I just want to jump in and add to what Ed said. I totally agree. And also what doesn't give me hope for the Republican Party kind of coming to its senses and adapting to a new reality is look at how they dealt with 2012 when they thought they were going to win. They very much lost the presidential election. They did the now very famous autopsy that talked about outreach to Hispanics, about dealing with immigration, and also very famously did the exact opposite of everything in that autopsy report. And over the last 2 days, I've been talking to establishment Republicans, for lack of a better term, and, you know, they're kind of saying the same things of we need more outreach to minorities, we need to adapt conservative ideas, we need to translate them better to these minority communities. But at the same time, they all acknowledge that it's not very likely to happen because they have this huge fight looming in the Republican Party after the election. As one Republican operative put it to me, 2016 was supposed to be about mom and dad finally having out their differences, i.e. the Tea Party wing, again, for lack of a better term, of the Republican Party and the establishment wing, who have been duking it out in Congress and across the nation for the last 8 years. And instead, as this GOP operative said, instead the crazy uncle shows up, hijacks Thanksgiving dinner, and, you know, by the end of the night, he'll be gone. There'll be food everywhere, shattered china everywhere, or gina, as Alec Baldwin says. But mom and dad still haven't had the fight in front of the kids, and they still haven't figured out their differences and whether or not they're going to get a divorce or, you know, or couples therapy. And so how much outreach to minorities can you really do when your party is still at war with itself? Because Donald Trump, on one hand, exacerbated those divisions, but also kicked that can down the road because they're still trying to figure out what to do with this running reality show as opposed to figuring out where the party is supposed to head in the future.
Well, Rosa, you know, it seems to me that, I mean, that's an interesting metaphor and so forth, but
been tracking the metaphors, and so far we have Lansing boils, circling wagons, Thanksgiving dinner with crazy uncle, kicking cans, and reality shows.
Yeah, well, and that's a sign that we're looking at.
I think reality show is a metaphor, though. I think that's a real descriptor.
Well, I think that's a sign that we're looking for a way to sort of define this as something bigger than it is. But just getting to the metaphor, I think anybody who thinks that, you know, the crazy uncle's going to leave and that this is going to go back to mom and dad working it out and then we'll, you know, the Republican Party will be able to figure out its course going forward isn't really paying attention. This is profoundly ugly and it actually affects real human beings. I was just in the Southwest. I was talking to a bunch of young people who are primarily Latino in origin. They view Donald Trump and the Republican Party as the party of racism. They view Donald Trump and the Republican Party as the party of trying to break up their families, deport their mothers. They see this as an existential threat. It's not a crazy uncle. It's not an exercise in reality television. And across the country, you are seeing other groups affected this way. You know, I encourage anybody in our audience to try this. Write a tweet or post something on Facebook that accuses Donald Trump of being an anti-Semite. And within moments, these, you know, sort of dark forces out there will manifest themselves and attack the person in the most brutal possible way. And this leaves scars. And I'm just wondering, Rosa, to you, you know, I mean, do you think this is just a sort of some passing thing?
No, the metaphor of the crazy uncle is misleading in the sense that mom and dad have always had plenty of crazy uncle in them to start with. You know, Trump has come to symbolize a lot of stuff, and Trump's own willingness to be overt about what Republican Party leaders have always been non-overt about has obviously empowered people to come out into the open in a new kind of way. But this has always been there. You know, this has absolutely always been there. And the difference today is, I think, two things. You know, one, I think, is that the mainstream American culture is more attuned to calling it out, to calling out misogyny, to calling out racism, whether it's in its more subtle manifestations or its more overt manifestations. You know, so one thing we're more attuned to calling it out, and two, it's more overt. But it's always been there. I mean, the Republican Party, you know, the phrase, you know, dog whistles to its sort of white and very racist core. You know, that's been the case for many, many decades. So, you know, nothing new. And I can't help but adding something that I think is important to talk about, even though it's one of those things that every time anybody says it, people immediately kind of go, oh, well, yeah, duh, of course, and they move on to something else. But it's probably worth spending more time on. And that is that in addition to the distortions of democracy that result from deliberate gerrymandering of electoral districts to dilute the voting power of minority communities, our Constitution itself is structured in a way that for the foreseeable future will dilute the voting power of exactly those minority groups, even when they become, nationally speaking, majority groups. I mean, to mention just the most obvious piece of this, the Senate, the two votes, two senators per state, regardless of the state's population. The more sparsely populated, more rural states also tend to be states that have smaller minority populations, and yet they have outsized votes. In the Senate, they have outside ability to block judicial nominees. They have about outside ability to control American foreign policy. You know, so this country is not a democracy in any meaningful sense. It never has been, and it is certainly not now. And we need to be talking about that. We have such a powerful myth about America as the world's leading democracy, blah, 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 that when anybody mentions something like that, everybody acts as though that's just sort of tedious little detail that we don't need to spend any time talking about. But it's actually unconscionable. It'd be unconscionable today if we saw some other fledgling democracy or newly independent country try to create a voting system that gave such disproportionate power to a particular ethnic group in that manner, in a way that would sort of lock it in semi-permanently as the ruling elite. We would be shocked and we would denounce it. But that's the system that we have today.
A very interesting and salient point. We've got about 15 minutes, and so I want to break this into two chunks here, although there's clearly lots that we can talk about. But picking up on the constitutional point, one of the things that has been troubling to me, because I've never seen this before in a U.S. election, is the fact that Trump, for the past couple of weeks, has essentially been running on the notion that this election is rigged, and has been fanning the flames of unrest among his supporters, saying, challenge it, there'll be violence in the streets, there'll be people with pitchforks and torches, this is, you know, the elites
probably
are trying to force...
Forget pitchforks.
Possibly. But, you know, there's a term for what Trump is doing, and it's called sedition, and it's actually against the law. It's against the law for somebody to go out and incite an uprising against the authority of the state, and particularly to do so in a way that could be so damaging to the United States. And, you know, you could get 20 years in a federal prison for sedition. And this is the textbook definition of it. And yet we sort of accept it, just like we accept a lot of the other clownish behavior from Trump. Although the day after this election, to the extent to which there's violence or unrest or people are contesting its outcome, the consequences might be significantly greater. Ed, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I think I share your foreboding about what might be the situation on November the 9th. You know, I do think that when we go through Republicans, not just in the swing states, and ask, well, do you still support Trump? And you've got five different answers. You know, some don't. Some just refuse to answer. They, like Mitch McConnell, they just keep their counsel. You know, others unendorse, then re-endorse, and then others stick to their guns and support Trump. I think for those who are wavering, which is the vast majority, just hoping, you know, it will go away, maintaining an ostrich-like position, they're a bit short-sighted, because on November the 9th, they're all going to be asked, do you believe this election was rigged? At which point, they cannot say, yes, we believe it was rigged, unless they wish to put their shoulder to the wheel of a constitutional crisis, civil disorder, and possible sedition. And, you know, I think that is a question that they won't be able to avoid. If Trump carries out his threat, pre-confessed, a bit like his alleged crimes against women, pre-confessed before he does it. If he carries out his threat of alleging this is rigged and claiming the whole thing was fixed and having Russia, do its bit to assist that impression, then the Republican Party will have no place to hide. It will have to answer yes or no. Are we with you on this or are we not with you on this? And I have to believe they will not be with Trump on this.
I don't know that the Republican Party has a place to hide right now because, I understand. But I mean, Mitch McConnell and these others are sitting on the fence and they're saying, well, we're not going to get involved. But the brand of the Republican Party has been redefined by Donald Trump and his supporters. And it's not going to go away overnight. There's a generation of young people who are going to rise up and the main election they're going to remember is this one. Julia, what do you think about this seditious behavior?
Well, this isn't the first time that Trump has been essentially breaking the law during his run for presidency. Remember the time he called for Russia to hack American servers to find those emails that Hillary Clinton deleted? I believe that violated some laws as well. He's notorious for alleging things are rigged. People have dug up his tweets where he said that the fact that The Apprentice didn't get an Emmy, that was rigged. When he was running in the primaries, he said if he didn't win, it was rigged. And what was this number? There was that magic number of delegates that he had to reach. And he said, that's a totally made up number. It's not legitimate. It's all rigged. And then as soon as he reached that number, he was totally fine with it and saw it as legitimate. I think it's ironic, several things that are happening in his campaign, that he's alleging the system is rigged for Hillary Clinton while inviting Russia, who is already doing plenty, to rig the system on his behalf. It just, I don't know, like many things he has said and done, it all kind of cancels itself out into this like dangerous noise. The same thing when the last kind of the nuclear option in his tactical arsenal was bringing up Bill Clinton's infidelities and how Hillary Clinton was an quote-unquote enabler because she went after these women and called them names. And what is he doing now with people who have accused him of sexual assault? He's saying they're lying. He's saying they weren't pretty enough for him to sexually assault. Again, it's self-serving, but it's obviously really dangerous. I was reminded over the weekend when I saw that story you were referring to in the Boston Globe where Trump supporters were calling for violence and calling for assassinating Hillary Clinton. It reminded me of the 90s when Bill Clinton was president and we had this resurgence of white militias and, all of which culminated in Timothy McVeigh bombing Oklahoma. But it reminded me of one of the first events I covered when I moved back from Russia in 2012, and that was President Obama's inauguration, second inauguration. And I remember standing there in the cold and watching Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee give a little speech, and it was the most grudging, mean-spirited speech ever. But what he was saying, through clenched teeth was, we don't like this guy, but America is about the peaceful transfer of power, so, here we are. And I was surrounded by a lot of African-Americans watching this, and they booed him, and they were upset. I had tears running down my face because to me, I had just come from Russia where Putin was starting to crush the pro-democracy movement that erupted when he announced that he was coming back for a third and not totally legal presidential term. I had friends who were facing jail time for, just yelling in the streets during a protest. And here I was back in civilization where this guy who clearly hated Barack Obama was saying, I don't like him, but that's how it goes. We're about the peaceful transfer of power. And it just gets back to this year and the last 2 years around the world where everybody just seems intent on relearning the basics, reinventing the wheel, as it were. And just, do we have a peaceful transfer of power? Do we need that? Do we need a Europe whole, free, and at peace? Relitigating some of these basic givens that we've all kind of taken for granted. And in the last couple of years, we've just decided to dismantle them and examine them and see if they're really worth being a given. And that's really dangerous.
I think there's we're going to have a test of American character here to see whether the old values prevail. Clearly, they are under threat and a greater threat than they have seen before. We just have about 5 minutes left, and so I'd like to turn to each of you to get a take on this issue of Russian involvement, because, you know, it manifests itself in a variety of different ways. It manifests itself in terms of the hacking, which the intelligence community feels very strongly that, you know, has come from the Russians. It also manifests itself in terms of the ties of Trump, the remarkable, I mean, really, really remarkable degree to which he takes Russian talking points at every turn, defends Russia despite the odious and threatening behavior of the Putin administration, to down to the small details. You know, whenever I write something or say tweet something, I get this bunch of responses. And some high number of the responses seem to be from bots or Twitter participants who aren't in the United States, who do seem to have some kind of origin in Russia. Nothing like this has ever happened before. It is going to deeply and permanently scar the relationship. If Hillary Clinton becomes president of the United States and must deal with Putin, it's not just going to be as an aggressor in Europe or an aggressor in Syria or as a generally bad guy. It's going to be as somebody who tried to destabilize processes in America. I'd like to go to each one of you for a minute or two and get your take on how seriously we should view this Russian involvement, beginning with Rosa.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I don't feel like I know. I don't feel like we know. I'm inclined, partly because I'm generally skeptical of almost all conspiracy theories, I'm inclined to be somewhat doubtful that the Russians have made a definite decision that they would like to have Donald Trump in the White House, not least because I actually think Putin, for all his many, many flaws, is not an idiot. And I think Putin is probably able to tell that Trump is actually pretty dangerous, you know, because he has temper tantrums every 5 minutes and he changes his mind, you know, that whatever sort of surface appeal of Trump there might be and whatever appeal there is for Putin in generally causing confusion to the United States, I'm not sure that Putin thinks it's in Russia's interest to end up with Donald Trump, you know, in control of nuclear codes or anything like that. So my instinct is that Russia is absolutely, yes, trying to cause confusion and embarrassment for the United States broadly, in part through hacks and so forth during this election campaign, but that Russia is not actively trying to get Trump elected would be my hunch. And I also don't think, in fact, that there is anything particularly new about any of this. The United States has meddled overtly and covertly in elections around the world for the last couple of centuries. So I, you know, while I'm troubled by it and concerned by it, I certainly don't think that it's some kind of shocking new thing that is happening.
Ed.
I like your question about how is it that a Clinton administration will handle relations after this with Russia. And you know, we talked about a reset when she was Secretary of State. This would have to be a reboot. I mean, some computer image would be better. Maybe a completely new iMac is in order. I predict, and this is a wild prediction, that the Theresa May government is going to at some point storm the Ecuadorian embassy and extradite Julian Assange to Sweden. I think that there are bylaws in Britain that enable the overall diplomatic immunity clause to be unbreached and to get Assange out of there. WikiLeaks is clearly hand in glove with the Trump campaign, with various elements of shadowy Russian intelligence agencies. Julie can speak much better on that than me, and with the alt-right too. So you know, there's got to be a big impact on how Clinton and how U.S.-Russia relations unfold, assuming it's a Hillary administration. I don't know what that is, but it's kind of without precedent, except Rosa's point that there's a precedent of America interfering with elections. But there is no precedent of, other than my country, you know, in the very early years of the Republic, attempting to interfere directly with American politics. And it will be fascinating to see what consequences this kind of behavior will have for the Putin regime.
Last word goes to Julia, who has obviously spent a lot of her time thinking about and working in Russia. So what is your take on it?
Well, one thing I want to circle back on is the other unprecedented thing and probably illegal thing that Trump has advocated in his campaign is locking up Hillary Clinton, mostly because she's his political opponent. Anyway, about Russia, I agree with Rosa, and I think to some extent, and I think that is how the Russians, especially Putin and his cohort, see things. To them, they're just playing the same game they see us as playing, which is supporting pro-democracy movements in Russia's backyard, regime change in Libya and Iraq, and attempted regime change as they see it in Syria, which they're fighting against. On the other hand, I disagree with Rosa because the Russian media has been very, for the last year, as soon as it became clear that Trump was the front runner, and he started saying things like, you know, we need to withdraw, we need to kind of withdraw from the world, and Putin's a great leader and he's a genius, and they have thrown in very, very heavily for Trump. So if you watch Russian television, which is still the way that over 90% of Russians get their news, and which Russians overwhelmingly trust, and it's all about how Trump is this great and very reasonable candidate that he is, he believes, as one Russian commentator put it, believes in healthy isolationism, that the U.S. is overextended and therefore needs to pull back. And that's good for the U.S., but of course it's good for Russia. And I don't agree that a volatile Trump is bad for Putin, because Putin doesn't make decisions the way we think he makes decisions. We often superimpose this Western logic onto him that he doesn't do things that, you know, would harm his economy. Like, I remember the summer of 2008, people were saying he would never invade Georgia, would crash his economy. Well, guess what? It did crash his economy, but he invaded anyway because he doesn't care. And he cares more about the geopolitical might of Russia, and he knows that it plays really well inside Russia, even if that causes economic hardship. You know, it's this belief that fairly well-founded that the Russian people are willing to suffer for a great idea and to live in an empire. So if he has and, you know, he'll do well with a Clinton presidency as well, because he'll have a great enemy in the White House that he can use to drum up this kind of the jingoism we've been seeing for the last 4 years in Russia since he officially came back to power. But, you know, I've been talking to friends in Russia and they're saying we're not seeing anything right now about these sexual assault allegations. They're just showing us how Trump is doing really well, how he's this refreshing antidote to the corruption of the American government. It's also, I mean, this whole fight is amazing for Putin, right? It's all been about how inefficient and sloppy democracy is. And wouldn't you rather have a benevolent, efficient, illuminated czar in the Kremlin? So there's no better teaching example than this for him.
Well, look, you know, I think that's a very thoughtful analysis. And it touches upon a number of things. But if you take the course of our discussion now over the course of the past 35 minutes, what you end up with is this. This is not a reality show. We can't switch the channel. Racism, misogyny, anti-Semitism, disrespect for the law, promotion of sedition, playing footsie with foreign governments, encouraging foreign intelligence services to intervene in the U.S. election. All of these things will have a lasting effect, both domestically within the United States and internationally within the U.S. relations with our allies and with our rivals. Hillary Clinton's probably going to win this election. But the
Don't
damage,
the
well, yeah, if only this podcast had that kind of power. But if she does, Donald Trump is still going to have had a lasting effect on how America works, how America is perceived internationally, and on U.S. international relations. And I think it's very important to sort of drill down, understand that, and given what a malevolent force he is, try to find ways to counteract it. That's the end of this podcast. We'll continue to discuss these and also global issues as we go forward in the weeks to come. Before we go, I'd like to thank Julia Yaffe, Rosa Brooks, Ed Luce, and all of you for joining us, and we'll talk to you again next week. Thank you very much. You have been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER podcast. I'm David Rothkopf, and I've been your host. The program is produced by Maria Ori and Ann Kingston. For more information about FP and to subscribe to this and our Global Thinkers podcast, please visit foreignpolicy.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get podcasts. Thank you very much for joining us.